This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Stories and just hold on to us and cry.
Barbara Koppel, director of Running From Crazy, and actress Mariel Hemingway. The film focuses on Mariel Hemingway's family history of mental illness and the suicides of seven relatives, including her sister, supermodel Margot, and her grandfather, the great writer Ernest Hemingway. That does it for today's show. If you want a copy, go to our website at democracynow.org. Special thanks to Elizabeth Press and John Hamilton. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Armand Newman, Shake, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcoff. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is more talk radio with hosts Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. Today's guest is journalist Stephen Rosenfeld, author of The Surprising Unknown History of the NRA.
When the desert sun goes down.
Hi, this is Retta Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree, and I want to invite you to a live music benefit for KBOO, Once in a Blue Moon, featuring eclectic mix of music performed by KBOO DJs. Included are Henry and Moggy from Swingin' Country, the True Vine Ramblers, Bluegrass from the True Vine, Don McLaren and his fiddling friends from Swingin' Country, and me, Retta Christie, playing swing music with my One Night Stand band. There will also be delicious desserts and coffee, raffles and silent auction. Support KBOO Saturday, February 23rd at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church, 7 to 10 p.m. Tickets are available through Brown Paper Tickets. You can also find it at kboo.fm/boomoon2013.
I watch that desert sun go down.
KBOO Radio is proud to help Zippity News and a clothes drive to help clothe the homeless. We will be collecting gloves, hats, and scarves until February 15th, when the clothes will be distributed throughout the homeless community. KBOO is located on 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, just off Burnside. Thank you, and we hope to see you donating clothes to help keep the homeless warm this winter.
Good morning.
You are listening to your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 if you are in the Columbia River Gorge, 100.7 in the Willamette River Valley. On the internet, in the ether, it's www.kboo.fm. This is More Talk Radio. Good Monday morning.
My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey.
And joining us this morning is Stephen Rosenfeld, who has been a journalist for nearly 30 years.
recently he's written a series of articles that can be found on alternate.org that explores the history and the philosophy of the NRA. One article that got our attention was an article he wrote entitled The Surprising Unknown History of the NRA. And this morning we will have a discussion with him about the NRA, about the gun lobby, and about proposals for gun controls that are in the national conversation at this point in time.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. See both of you.
Well, first, we'd like you to introduce yourself and tell us what is it about America's love affair with guns and the NRA that captured your attention?
Well, sure. Well, I am, as you said, I've been a reporter for somewhere between 25 and 30 years, depending on how you count. I started in Vermont, where I covered local government and the state legislature and all kinds of things there, and poverty and environment and health and taxes. And then I got involved. I moved out west. I live in California now, and I became a public radio reporter. I first did some documentaries on population, and I did some other, and the environment, and then reproductive health. And then I became a reporter for National Public Radio in the late 90s, where I covered money and politics. I was the outside Washington guy. Peter Overby was the inside Washington guy. Then I got involved in covering voting rights after the 2004 presidential election, what happened in Ohio, and I wrote some books, and I've done a lot of stuff on voting rights and constitutional issues. And about a year and a half ago, I got a fellowship from a foundation that was known for supporting investigative reporting, and I was covering the issue of corporate constitutional rights and democracy issues after the whole Citizens United thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, against that backdrop, I was asked to take a look at the NRA and the Second Amendment and gun control issues. And what I found was an amazingly deep, rich, and kind of unknown topic in a lot of ways. So it's been completely fascinating to go into the history of this and go into the law and go into, you know, the politics. Because what the NRA has put out there basically as propaganda for the last 30 years, and people now accept it as true, is not. And there's a remarkable history there where it only leads to one conclusion, which is gun controls have always existed with gun privileges when you go back through the history. And any other interpretation besides that is just completely fabricated, and we can really get into it. The NRA was for gun control for more than 100 years. They even wrote the first gun control laws, and the NRA, a lot of their members are in favor of gun controls. And they're not the all-powerful political organization people that they claim to be. The last time there were major gun control laws, they made some super big mistakes, and they lost. And they didn't just lose because of Democrats. They lost because they were, I dare say, more than annoying Republicans, powerful Republicans. And they always have the same fundamentalist hyperbole. And what happens is, as the tides change and time changes, they move in and out of sync, more or less, with the public sentiment. And that brings us to today. And in fact, what was proposed last week by Dianne Feinstein, California senator, it actually follows the same imprint of laws that were passed by the Congress 25 years ago. There's nothing radical in it.
Well, let's share, because what you reveal in your articles are things that maybe some people take as fact and, as you suggest, are not fact. Just tell us briefly about the founding of the NRA and its original objectives and maybe its understanding of the Second Amendment or what was that a concern back in the 1870s.
Well, the NRA was founded in 1871. By two New Yorkers, one of whom was an ex-New York Times reporter, and they were really upset that the Civil War had gone on longer than it needed to, and they felt it did because basically Northerners or Yankees or Union soldiers couldn't shoot as well as the Southerners. So what they decided to do was they decided to create sort of like a marksmanship training society, and they had, this is also key, they were partners with government, including the cops, from the very, very beginning. They got money from the New York State Legislature for to buy property for rifle ranges. They went back repeatedly, and that's what they were for decades. In fact, when they felt that the state money was going to dry up, they went to Congress, and they got, in the early 1900s, they got... there were federal laws passed that basically gave them a monopoly on training and working with the police, and they got surplus guns from the Army. So you compare and contrast that today with how they say government is, you know, just this bastion of tyranny, and they are the last line of, you know, patriotic defense. It's nonsense. They were subsidized by the people they're calling tyrants for decades and decades. And at that time... you know, there are state constitutions and the federal constitution. Mm-hmm. Nobody thought that the Second Amendment, federal amendment, conferred an individual right to bear arms. There were state constitutions that occasionally were said there's a right to have a gun for self-defense, apart from what you would call militia purposes. The Second Amendment is a confusing, jumbled statement that was basically written to appease disgruntled Revolutionary War veterans who felt that they were paying taxes like in the same way that they were paying under the British. And it said that, you know, a well-regulated militia, you know, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The key part of that phrase, like all the constitutional amendments, is the opening clause, a well-regulated militia. And what that was all about, historically, was in the late 1700s and early 1800s, you know, the early Americans didn't want to have a standing army like the European nations, because they felt the Europeans were using their standing armies to oppress people. And that basically completely evaporated with the War of 1812, because the Americans tried to raise a standing army to defend the city of Washington, and the British burned it to the ground. Then there was some notion, well, I guess we better have a real army trained. And, you know, police forces, professional ones in cities, didn't come until 50 or 75 years later, really. But the point is, even in the early 1800s, states passed the kinds of gun control laws that today the NRA says are completely anathema. You weren't allowed to carry concealed weapons in a lot of, you know, southern states, what we call today red states. In some other states, you had to show up once a year and have your guns inspected. There were registries, you know, of every gun and every owner in the state. All the stuff today that, you know, the NRA would say is completely off the charts and through the roof and the height of tyranny. And this went on. What happened was, after the Civil War, there was a giant infusion of guns into people's hands. And when they brought them home after the war, both North and South, states started passing even more gun controls. So out west, you weren't allowed to walk into a lot of these frontier towns without checking a gun at the sheriff's office.
Now say something more, because we have, you know, the Hollywood image of the Wild West.
Right, the mythology of folks carrying in their guns.
The Hollywood image is only real men settle their disputes with guns. It's actually completely upside down. You know, these towns, these frontier towns, where all these Westerns were filmed, were no different than the towns that are like outside state capitals today in the West. They're run by chambers of commerce who are looking for business. They don't want people running around the streets with guns. They want people coming in and like opening up stores and shops. So you had to check in your guns. So the Tombstone, Arizona, where they made that shootout at the OK Corral movie, you know, four or five different versions of it, even Star Trek episodes based on it.
Mm.
They had, it was over, the fight there was over people who didn't check their guns at the local sheriff. They had more stringent gun controls there than people have now. And, you know, Dodge City, same thing. And these states, they, you know, states like Texas, states like Florida, you know, southern states and other western states, you were not allowed to carry a concealed gun. The governor of Texas famously said, you know, the purpose of a concealed gun is murder. He basically said real men don't need it. And what happened was, you know, as, you know, the decades keep flying by, in the 1930s, during the era of Prohibition, where alcohol was banned, organized crime it escalated. The cops felt they were outgunned by mobsters using machine guns.
And which is the counterpart to our automatic weapon.
Yeah, that's, yes. And when we say, like, yes, exactly, you know, and well, we could say what is an automatic and what's a semi-automatic and all that sort of stuff. But the thing is, the NRA helped write the first federal firearm laws. Now, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, there was an assassination attempt on his life early in his first term. And he survived, of course. And then he made gun control or fighting crime as part of his New Deal. And there were at that point they banned. Well, what they did was they were afraid they wanted to take machine guns out of circulation, so they imposed high taxes on them, and it basically worked. And then it was 1934, 1938. There was a series of federal gun control laws, and the NRA helped write them, and they said they were no threat to sportsmen. And, you know, and this notion of the Second Amendment conferring an individual right was just not, it was nobody's conception of the law. In the 60s, the NRA was initially still pro-gun control. The gun that was used, the rifle that was used to kill John F. Kennedy was an Italian military surplus rifle that Lee Harvey Oswald bought from a classified ad in an NRA magazine, American Rifleman. And the head of the NRA at that time, or their chief lobbyist, you know, came to Congress and basically said no sane and patriotic American could possibly oppose, you know, banning the instrument that killed the president. That was 1964. In 1968, after Martin Luther King was shot, and after, you know, Bobby Kennedy was shot, and there was lots of, and in California, there were, you know, in other cities, there were these urban riots that had gone on for summers over racial inequalities, and there was another gun control law that was passed, and that created, like, more regulation on some dealers and background checks, and well, very basic systems. And the NRA was, they didn't like all of it, and they got rid of a national registry of all gun owners, and President Johnson at the time signed it saying it could be stronger. But they wrote to their sportsmen saying, you know, we can live with this. Now, you know, what ended up happening was some of the gun dealers and some of the people who were, you know, at that time a lot of people were distrustful of government for a lot of different reasons. Well, there was a libertarian fringe in the NRA that felt that nobody should touch their guns, and they wanted somebody to. They were waiting for a more expansive interpretation of the Second Amendment. Just like, well, what they did was they saw that the courts were giving the civil rights movement expansive interpretations of the First Amendment. You know, freedom of assembly and all that sort of stuff that became, you know, the fabric of the civil rights movement. And they said, well, what about us? What about the gun movement? And, you know, people looked at them and they thought they were nuts. But within the NRA, they kept pushing. And in the late 70s, there was an internal takeover of political coup, leadership coup, led by people who have this belief. And the guy who led it was the George Zimmerman of his era. He was somebody who, as a teenager, provoked a fight with somebody and shot and killed that other teenager. He was white. The person he shot and killed was a Latino. He was down in Texas, and he got off for self-defense, you know, given the courts at the time. And they loved this guy. You know, who better to lead this type of an NRA than somebody who uses guns this way? And then what happened was Reagan came into office, and the NRA was helped, and their gun clubs helped get him elected, and then it gets complicated, but Reagan helped pass some Under Reagan, some of the federal gun controls were reeled back, but the NRA also overreached and made a lot of bungling mistakes, and they really pissed a lot of people off. And they had to, and during that time, they lost the support of the cops and law enforcement and mayors. They still don't have that support today. And they showed they could overreach and that, you know, that and their absolute politics are what we have today. But
now,
First let people know that we're speaking with Stephen Rosenfeld. We're talking about the amazing history of the National Rifle Association. This is More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 in the city. To join our conversation as we discuss the history of the NRA and its implications on federal policy today, federal gun control and crime control with guns efforts, join us at 503-231-8187. Now, I want to take for a moment and carve a little segment out of there, because one of the things you've done in other articles is you've showed how much the NRA has strayed from its original philosophy and ideology and even practice. And have pointed out that some of the very people who supported measures of gun control flip. Now, granted, his reason was, I think, more of political currying of favor more than profound insight. But when he was governor, Ronald Reagan had asserted back in the late 60s that there was actually no reason for any person to carry a loaded gun on the streets. So when you reference him changing his position, again, as I call it, political, you know, currying, can you talk a little bit about those kinds of shifts? Because those were incremental.
Well, yeah, Reagan was, you know, he was not just the great communicator, he was the great equivocator.
Well, yes.
I mean, you know, okay, so when he's governor in May 1967, the Black Panthers, which were very active in Oakland, some of their members went to law school in San Francisco, and they realized that in the state of California, you were allowed to carry a loaded gun on the streets as long as it wasn't pointed at anybody. You could point it to the ground, point it to the sky. So there were some gun controls that were being proposed in Sacramento, and there was this philosophy that they couldn't, in Oakland, that the Black Panthers didn't trust the Oakland cops because they were just, you know, they were white, and they were aggressive, and they were racist, and they were bigoted, so they will start policing themselves. And you know, the idea of, you know, these young Black men with afros and with some women too running, you know, driving around with guns, you know, in their cars, visible for it, was just driving everybody in white establishment circles nuts. Well, then the Black Panthers went up to the State House when there was supposed to be a hearing on, this is, you know, and this is, you can see pictures of this in, you know, LA Times, May 1967. And they had to let them in, and they walked in, you know, two dozen people carrying rifles, loaded rifles. And it's almost funny because they didn't even know how to find the hearing room. So they walked in, and they walked around, and then they finally left. And that's when Reagan, you know, very famously said, you know, reasonable people don't need guns to settle disputes. Nobody should walk around the streets these days, you know, with guns. At the same time, Richard Nixon said that, you know, it wasn't for guns. And then what happened was, you know, when Reagan ran, The Republican Party, they didn't really, you know, they saw the NRA as being an organization of sportsmen and hunters and marksmanship trainers that helped the cops. And they didn't see it as being, you know, this sort of led by libertarians who are seeking a expanded version of the Second Amendment that very handily, you know, helps America's gun makers, you know, sell, you know, a zillion new products. And you know, when Reagan got into office, he survived an assassination attempt in March of 81. Mm-hmm. And unlike Roosevelt, you know, almost, you know, 40 years before that or so, he didn't come out and say we need gun controls. He said we don't need any. He says, I believe in your version of the Second Amendment. And it was a Hollywood version of the Second Amendment. Right. You know, it was this gunslinger thing, which, I mean, I don't mean to be so slangy, but it was everybody knows what the cowboy cliche is, and the NRA loved it. And then when it's funny because at that point they did unravel some of the federal firearms laws, opening up licensing requirements, but at the end of Reagan's and Reagan, you know, his press secretary Brady, who was shot and has permanent brain damage, and the whole Brady bill and Brady law and all that is named after him, and that's for background checks. He wouldn't support the Brady bill when he was in office. When he got out of office, he supported the Brady bill. In fact, he very famously then said, this is reasonable, it's not going to hurt hunters. And then by then, no one wanted to pay attention to him. And the NRA attacked him, saying, oh, you liberals, well, you said he was a troglodyte, for years and years and years, and now you're saying he makes, he's smart and wise? What's up? I mean, but, it was completely politically expedient.
Well, not only was it politically expedient, but it talks about it highlights the shift and or the split within some circles. I want you to share a little bit about the opposition to this libertarian view by conservatives. Talk something about Anthony Scalia, Warren Burger, and the divide between conservatives and people who are. I think one judge said that Scalia rulings were faux originalism.
Yeah. Obviously. The stories that I have written and the viewpoint that it comes across from them is that there has been a joint history of gun control and gun privileges. I don't want to call them rights. I want to call them privileges because government grants privileges. And they've coexisted for most of the country's history. And that's the reasonable balance where things need to go back to. I haven't been out there saying, that the Constitution claims, that American life should only be such and such a way, and it cannot change, and we must adhere to those original principles. Well, that's what Scalia, today people call really hardcore right wing, judges and thinkers and public intellectuals say. That they are. They claim to be defenders of those original principles. Well, the original interpretation of the Second Amendment until Scalia wrote the most outrageous decision probably of his tenure on the Supreme Court as an example of judicial activism, which I'll come to in a second, was that the Second Amendment did not confer an individual right to have an individual, unfettered, unrestricted right to guns. It wasn't in the federal constitution. And Warren Burger was Nixon's chief justice. He was a law and order guy. And part of the reason that the Supreme Court over the decades of the 20th century did not want to give, see this large gun, this Second Amendment as being like an unfettered right to guns, was they believed in law and order, and for better or worse, the federal government's ability to enforce law and order. And they sided as they do now with establishment power. They sided with the cops, and so what happened was after Warren Burger left the Supreme Court and he retired in 1986, the same day Scalia went up to the bench, and afterwards he was really appalled that the NRA was out there touting this version of the Second Amendment that he didn't think existed, and he spoke out against it. And this guy was no liberal. There was a magazine at the time that was an insert in all kinds of Sunday newspapers called Parade Magazine. He wrote about it. And he went on public television, and he called it one of the greatest frauds ever perpetuated by a public interest group in his lifetime. I mean, he was that. And he called for gun controls. He called for banning pistols, which at that point was like the weapon of, biggest weapon of concern. They called them
Saturday night specials. Yes,
they were cheap. I mean, today the equivalent is the semi-automatic, military-style rifles. And he said, just to give you an idea of what is, you compare this to what's being proposed today. He said that every time someone sells a gun, it should be like selling a car or a house. There should be a title transfer. You know, it should be treated that way. And now that was 1990. You know, that wasn't 1890 or 1790. That was 1990. And this was no liberal. So what happened was Washington, D.C. has a particular relevance for lawyers and politicians because of its government structure. There is no state government layer between local government, the city council, and the federal courts. So what happens is people look to file lawsuits in Washington as the quickest way to get to the Supreme Court. And because, you know, the federal government is based there, that's where a lot of litigation against the federal government is started, and that's why it's there. So what happened was some libertarian lawyers decided to challenge Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban. And in the mid-70s, Washington, D.C. banned handguns. And it didn't stop crime rates in the city. And they felt that they would find some sympathetic people, and they would just use this as the test case to go against the Second Amendment. They were seeking an enlarged reading of it. And the NRA at first opposed their lawsuit, and they tried to sabotage it and block it. And they stumbled, and they lost. And the reason they stumbled, and the reason they wanted to block it was they were afraid that they would lose.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted things to remain ambiguous, because when things remain ambiguous in law, they can make outsized, exaggerated, propagandized claims.
Yeah.
And so what happened was Scalia got to the court, and this case, it wound its way through, and 6 years later, it was called Washington, D.C. versus Heller. It was argued in March of 2008. It was just after Obama came into office. And it's the most outrageous. You know, these guys, like Scalia, claim that they're constitutional originalists. They don't claim that there's a living constitution. They don't claim that, you know, the country's history has changed and therefore we need to, you know, have laws that reflect those changes. You know, he believes in the constitution that says, you know, for the purposes of, you know, the census, you know, African Americans are 3/5 of a person. You know, that's what he says.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you know, that's the originalist constitution, and he claims to be an adherent of that. So he comes in, when they're arguing the Heller decision, he's answering the questions that other justices are asking these libertarian lawyers. They weren't the NRA. These guys outfoxed the NRA's clumsy lawyers. They brought this case in, and Scalia's answering the questions that the other justices are he's coaching them from the bench. And then, in the way the Supreme Court today has this, you know, right-left, 5-4, you know, split, he writes the majority decision, and he says that the Second Amendment contains an individual right to use a handgun for self-defense in the home. And
which at this time was not the perspective.
There were something like 40 state constitutions contain rights to use guns, you know, for non-militia purposes. And, you know, the NRA in the last 20 years has pushed states to adopt these, just like they pushed them to adopt these health care freedom acts, not the NRA, but, you know, like states to protest Obamacare, you know, this stuff like that. But none of this stuff rises to the level of the federal constitution, which is, you know, the ruling governing document. So this is it's the most outrageous example of judicial activism from somebody who claims to be an originalist. I mean, you know, if you believe in this stuff, well, just say you believe in it. Don't advertise yourself otherwise. But anyway. So where that leaves things today is, it's in an ambiguous place, because Scalia, you know, the NRA and the gun lobby thought, well, this is what we've been waiting for, and who would have thought it was possible that the Supreme Court would confirm or affirm that there's a right to having a handgun at home for self-defense in the Second Amendment. But where it leaves things is that And this is what where you know Obama comes in, and where Dianne Feinstein's bill comes in is everything else that's outside of that box, a handgun at home for self-defense, is acceptable to be regulated by the federal government. So if there's a silver lining, in the sort of parameters or the landscape of what can happen with the 2013's gun control debate, those are the ground rules. And if you take a look at what the executive orders that Obama signed, it's like almost two dozen of them. A lot of them seek to free up the restraints that Republicans in Congress have put on different branches of the federal government, so that there can actually be the possibility of better background checks, better public health research, so we actually know what is the real link between guns and violence. And the NRA has worked to change the debate away from public safety and violence, and to this sort of more conceptual freedom thing, where people get incensed about freedom as opposed to crime.
So they have shifted the vote, as you the debate somewhat from looking at analysis of the relationship between guns and violence, and focus so on this so-called constitutional freedom for gun ownership.
I'll give you another really striking example of that. Okay, so they stopped all the academic research was based on public health studies done by the Centers for Disease Control in the 1990s.
Yes, we were doing the epidemic of crime and gun crime.
They stopped funding for that research. So all of a sudden you can't, what that does is it leaves you with the inability to have an informed, modern, contemporary discussion. The Consumer Product Safety Commission can recall a plastic water pistol because if a two-year-old might choke on it, but they're not allowed to regulate, and no federal government can regulate gun manufacturers, including guns that accidentally go off if they're dropped. Mm-hmm. They're not allowed. So you can recall a toy gun, but you can't recall a real gun.
You're listening to, just a minute, please, Stephen. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. Our phone number is 503-231-8187 to join in the conversation. And we want to thank our caller for holding. Michael, you're on the air.
I want to challenge your speaker. The relationship between guns and Europeans in America is that this country was formulated by using guns. I mean, the first recipient of violence was the Native Americans. And so part of America's fascination with guns is not only that, but they look at Germany and what happened to the Jews, and they said if they had an armed society, that the Jews wouldn't have been sent to the gas chamber. So part of why America's fascination with guns, it's a racist fascination, but basically the ruling class, i.e. Europeans, want to keep guns in society because they feel that's their last defense against takeover from other racial groups or outside forces.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I just finished writing a book about what happened to the most famous Dutch Jewish boxer in World War II, mm-hmm. who defied the Nazis, and how he managed to live. It's not true that if the Jews had guns, it's just far too simplistic. You know, the thing about that is what the Germans did over, and it wasn't just an overnight thing, they spent, under the Nazis, they spent years removing civil liberties and all kinds of privileges, property rights, going to school, bank accounts, phones, when you're living like we live in America, or people were living there, you just can't pick yourself up and leave the country to fight the power of the totalitarian state. So, you know, it's just, I, you know, the NRA and people like to mention this, you know, this Jewish thing again. It's just not correct. It's utterly simplistic, and it really is not an accurate reading of history. You know, what the Nazis did was they removed civil liberties, you know, deliberately over, you know, there were hundreds and hundreds of decrees. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like they just came in and snapped their fingers and took people and started killing people, you know, without it coming down the pike. It's just that people, no one expected it to get as bad as it did. And
so how do you respond to, and I'm sure some people will say this, well, this is why we need to protect our gun laws, because mm-hmm. by having these restrictions, our government, national government, is doing the way of
right.
a totalitarian government.
Well, I'll government. Tell you, it's the
history, erosion
of
rights.
Mm-hmm. The history, look, we have to, gun ownership, you know, in modern America, is, you know, it's more of a privilege than it is a right, or I think it should be considered more of a privilege. And what I mean by that is, you know, no one is going to, it's naive to think that people are going to take people's guns away and someone's going to snap their fingers and America's 300 million guns are going to disappear and we're going to become like Great Britain. It's not going to happen. The guns are there, and most people who have them, you know, and use them, you know, or have them, you know, they're not criminals. But the point is that there are some that are not, you know, I lived in Vermont, which is a, you know, a rural part of the Northeast, you know, for 13 years. And I don't know people who go hunting deers, you know, with machine guns. In fact, you know, it's laughable. It's idiotic. It's not what, you know, that whole tradition is all about. And, So the thing is, it's there is this giant middle ground where the debate really needs to be informed, and it needs, that's where it needs to go. And it's, if you look at like what's in Dianne Feinstein's bill, it's not radical at all. Basically, what it does is it says that today's semi-automatic either pistols or rifles are not going to be taken away by anybody who owns them currently. But they're going to be not. They're not. They're going to stop making them, selling them, importing them, and to sort of to start shrinking the supply. And if somebody wants to sell one to somebody else, they have to get a background check. And her bill lists hundreds and hundreds of guns that people that are exempt, so that it doesn't interfere with the sportsman and hunting tradition.
Right. And it doesn't exacerbate this rural and urban use of weapons, because that's,
you know,
one of the other things. That's one of the other things that the NRA is trying to exacerbate, is to yeah. really frustrate urban America versus rural America. Before we touch yeah. on that, though, hold on to that, Stephen, because I've got another point, too, I want to bring up about how to get to the more moderate voices in the NRA. But we have a couple of callers here online, and we'll go to Randy first. Good morning, Randy.
Hi. There's lots of words tend to confuse these matters, and all these arguments that have been advanced and put to bed long ago, but they're still being trotted out here. Privilege or rights? Oh, come on. A living constitution? Are you kidding? And you only regulate the law abiding. You don't regulate the criminals.
Well, Randy, the Constitution itself says regulate the militia. So what exactly is your point?
It says shall not be regulated, the Second Amendment. Shall not be infringed.
It says infringed. It does say a well-regulated. So it says regulate guns. So I'm not understanding your point.
You know, the purpose of the Second Amendment was to put up resistance against government tyranny, of course.
Okay, let
our guest discuss it.
It's written about the Second Amendment.
The Second Amendment was not written that's the current... That's an ahistorical interpretation of it. That's a modern interpretation to justify unlimited gun usage. And what it does is, the line of reasoning that the caller suggests leads some people you know, to sort of go off the deep end, like Timothy McVeigh, who was an NRA member and was part of, you know, and had friends in the Michigan militia, you know, and didn't like the ATF because he thought that they were being too aggressive with being the federal regulators of firearms. And, you know, there are unbalanced people in every walk of life, of every ethnicity, of every age, of every sex. But, I mean, you know, but to say that, it's a modern fabrication, that interpretation. The militia that were of concern in the... we can get into the history here, but, you know, there's another amendment right next to the Second Amendment that has to do with the government shall not quarter soldiers in people's houses. You know, these are artifacts of, like, the politics of that time that really have nothing to do with the politics of today.
The principles remain the same. They're timeless principles. Self-defense, government tyranny never changed. Throughout human history, we've always had government tyranny. We always have the need for self-defense. There's always a chance. There's always...
Randy, yeah. I appreciate your point. What and I want our guests to talk about, because you talk about original intent, and I think what our guest has done convincingly is look at the original intent in the 18th century. And if anyone knew the meaning and the intent of the Second Amendment, it was certainly those states in the 1780s and 1790s. And if you look at the laws that they've written, that they wrote, that they abided by, they seem to be much more restrictive than what you claim is the original intent. Let our guests talk about the regulations in the 18th century.
Well, okay, so Randy, do you know what the Shays Rebellion was? Want to get into history? Let's talk history. Do you know what the Shays Rebellion is?
Hello, caller?
Okay.
Well, it sounds as though
let me just say. Okay,
we'll go,
yes. Okay. 6 months before the Continental Congress met to ratify the Bill of Rights, there was a rebellion. All of the guns from the Revolutionary War were kept in an armory in Springfield, Massachusetts. And there was a fellow whose last name is Shays who led a rebellion because they were disgruntled. There were people who didn't want to pay taxes then, and they tried to raid the armory to grab the guns, just like John Brown tried to do at Harper's Ferry,
yes,
the other big government armory, you know, 75 years later, but this before the start of the Civil War. The governor of Massachusetts calls out the militia members as akin to a state National Guard, and they put down that rebellion. As they go into the debates and passing of the Bill of Rights, the politics of that time didn't quite know how to deal with Revolutionary War veterans who were disgruntled. They didn't have pensions. They were paying taxes. Some of them had guns. Some of them didn't. So they put this amendment in there to allow states to call out people for the purposes of some kind of common defense. There weren't police departments. Those didn't exist, and that was the purpose of the militia at the time. They were supposed to be working, you know, as an agent of government in some kind of, you know, public service. They weren't seen as being, the last line of paranoid defense. Now there is a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things I don't particularly like about, you know, state and federal power today, but, you know, I don't necessarily think that owning a gun, you know, is my either expression of freedom or the best way to try to address those inequities. I think there are other ways to do it. I'm not saying that doesn't mean that, you know, you don't have a right to have a gun, but you know, guns are dangerous, you know, just like cars are dangerous, and they're regulated, and they're licensed. And you know, it's, and that's what Warren Berger said.
And most importantly, Steve, I think one of the things people need to remember is it's not calling for a ban on all guns. It's calling on a ban of certain guns and their use in everyday life. They're not called for in recreation. They're not called for in sport hunting.
Yeah, let's talk about this. What's really being proposed here? Because to be honest with you, the Feinstein thing proposal is, it's a lot. Let's talk about what it's not. It's not a national registry of gun owners. It's not gun confiscation. It's not any of that. It's basically, the machine guns have been illegal since the 1930s. And a machine gun means you hold the trigger and it keeps firing bullets. Well, innovations in technology have left us today with the ability, when this is what they mean by semi-automatic, to fire a succession of single bullets very quickly. So, you know, people can argue whether that's a machine gun or not, or today's semi-automatic is better or as efficient as yesteryear's machine gun. The point is that she wants to prevent people from using that type of gun in a, you know, in some kind of, you know, violent, you know, outburst or for some kind of grievance killing. So she wants to stop the manufacture and the importation of that kind of gun and the kind of magazine or what you would call, you know, the canister that holds, you know, more than 10 bullets. And if you have one of those guns, she's not going to take it away from you. But if you're going to sell it, you have to get a background check. And her proposal requires that you have a trigger lock so it doesn't go off accidentally, because no government agency regulates gun manufacturers. There are no safety regulations, because the gun lobby was very good at writing that into law. You know, so that's what's in that bill.
Right.
And that's not, you know, and if you go back to the 19, this is really important. The first version of the assault weapon bill ban that all the Democrats think, you know, is the reason that they can't challenge the NRA, it was proposed by Republicans.
Which is an important point in our legislative history. We do have another caller, and we only have a few minutes, and I really want to touch on how to get to the moderate voices within the NRA. So we'll go to our next caller here. Good morning, JB.
Hi. I have a slightly different perspective. I'm very radical. You know, I wouldn't even say politically, because I'm kind of anarchistic in my approach. But ultimately, I'm trying to approach life and the earth as it is, not as how I want it to be, just in terms of, you know, we are living in changing times. And ultimately, I believe that a person's access to a gun might very well mean the difference between life and death somewhere in the second half of this century. And I don't believe that, quite frankly, I don't believe that regulation is going to regulate the wealthy. It's certainly not going to regulate the army. It's certainly not going to regulate the people who want to do the most damage, but it will most definitely regulate the everyday person who, again, it might mean a matter of life and death and, you know, the downside of peak oil and...
We need you to get to your point really quickly, because you only have about 30 seconds.
Well, the point that I'm making is, while we're making these moves because we're trying to deal with some kind of ideal that exists in, you know, in an economy that is headed towards collapse, it has nowhere else to go.
So I
feel like we're kind of digging our own graves.
So
we're trying to, you know, we're basically like...
JB, do you have a question?
I think we could...
Your guest pointed out earlier that she feels like there are better ways, or nobody really needs a gun to make change. But if the change is already upon us, then does she really feel like being disarmed is the best option?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the question for Stephen.
What about the point that guns laws aren't for people who obey them, but for people who don't obey them, and people who are criminals are going to get them anyway?
Well, it may be that criminals will get them, but the police, as the police say, that in states where there have been gun controls, and when the assault weapon ban was in effect, was that they were confiscating far fewer of them from the actual criminals. Now, you know, it's a mistake to think that this bill is going to confiscate guns. It's going to just stop the availability of these weapons that have this, you know, semi-automatic firing capability and the parts that feed them more than 10 bullets at a time. Nobody is going to be taking anybody's gun away, and the Supreme Court says that you have a right to a handgun for self-defense in one's own home. But I got to tell you, you know, my father, who lives and works in New York City, has been robbed 3 or 4 times. And he's been hit over the head with a gun, and the New York City cops wanted him to get a gun, and he's a veteran. And you know what? He says, I don't know that I necessarily want to be in the position of having to decide whether I'm really going to use it. So, you know, you just think about that. You know, there's, you can have all this bravado and constitutional freedom talk and everything like that, but let's be real about, you know, what we're talking about here and who or how and when these things might actually come into use.
So do you think, as we wind down, Celeste asked about moderate voices. Is there a place, do you think we can find a way, a common ground?
It's going to be tough because politics in America has become about shouting past each other based on one's beliefs. And you know, people listen to echo chambers. They don't know how to really have a debate or a conversation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the business model. The business model of the media is confrontation. It's not dialogue and accepting compromise. But the history here is that America has always had, you know, the gun controls and gun privileges coexisting hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where things need to land.
Stephen, we thank you for your writing. Want to let people know that we've been speaking with Stephen Rosenfeld. You can check out his articles in alternet.org. Great research, great writing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for giving me this privilege.
Oh, it's been a privilege. And we also want to tell people that if you are curious about the article, you can check it out at our webpage at the KBOO website, which is www.kboo.fm/moretalkradio. And you can find the link there and then also go and visit other links. In the discussion about gun controls, gun violence controls, gun laws, as Stephen Rosenfeld has said, let us look for the middle ground, which basically said that we have constitutional rights that says that we may bear arms, but we should look at how we regulate our militia. This has been your Community Connection KBOO Portland. Coming up at 9 o'clock, the Old Mo Variety Hour talks about renewable energy with John Farrell and energy politics. Well-Read Red comments on Garfield High School teachers in Seattle and their direct resistance to neoliberal testing regime. And the Legal Moles talk about Mahmoud case and the dynamics of FBI sting operations. Eric Cascadia at 10 a.m. with Chris Andre, 10:15, Locust Focus with Barbara Bernstein. 11 o'clock, Grace Eagle Reed hosts a pilot program called Disability Awareness. And at 11:30, we'll hear Food Sleuth Radio with the Healthy Body Image here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.
January 25th, 2013, KBOO Navigator Report. We produced an outstanding 8-hour live broadcast of Keep Alive the Dream, the 28th anniversary tribute to Martin Luther King Jr. Thank you, remote broadcast team. This week, KBOO members will receive the first wave of new membership cards powered by Supportland. Enjoy the enhanced new benefits. KBOO will be producing live, on-location broadcasts of the 2013 Illihi Monthly Lecture Series, Who Owns You and What You Can Do About It, making this valuable information available to the entire community. Tune in, turn on, and remember, we'll air Tuesday, January 29th at 6 p.m., hear Sharon Wood Wortman share memories as a volunteer KBOO reporter in the 80s. If you have a story to share from KBOO's past, contact Lynn Fitch, 503 231-8032, extension 222, or navigator at kboo.org. This has been the Weekly Navigator Report. Thank you.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, Portland's only community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is our engineer. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing new perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events that dig deeper than the far too uncritical reporting and analyses of the conventional media. On today's program, Bill Resnick will be talking with Johan Farrell, who is the renewable energy expert for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. They'll be talking about the current struggles going on in the U.S. and Europe over who will ultimately control sun and wind power. I will share with you an article by Dave Windorf called What's Wrong with America? Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker are here with another segment of their Left and the Law series. Today we'll be talking about the Portland trial of Mohammed Mohammed, the dynamics of FBI sting operations. Alan Veeder closes out today's program with a commentary on the school testing boycott currently taking place at Seattle's Garfield High School. But now here's Bill talking with Johan Farrell of the Institute for Self-Reliance.
Thanks, Tom, and it's John Farrell. Sorry, John. Anyway, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thanks for having me. You know, I don't mind the Johan. I love those Germans and their renewable energy, and I think they'd call me Johan over there.
Okay. Well, we'll call you Johan for the rest of the... No, I'll call you John. John Farrell, that's with two R's and two L's. He's a senior researcher at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, specializes in energy, wrote the book Democratizing Energy. He knows as much as anybody about one of the great, truly profound contests of the struggles of the 21st century over who will own the sun and the wind. Will it be we the people running democratically, that is the energy production